Welcome to Linux Link Radio by TimeSys, a podcast for embedded Linux developers.
Welcome to Linux Link podcast by TimeSys. This is Maciej Halasz here. I'm with the product management team, and with me is Gene Sally.
Hi there.
We have had a lot of feedback after our last podcast that we've recorded. Roughly, it was 2 weeks ago now. Oh, wow, time flies.
Yeah.
We got a lot of questions and a lot of interest in a topic that we were covering then, which was how to speed up boot time of a Linux kernel and the entire Linux solution on an embedded system.
Yeah, I was really surprised to see that much feedback. I know when we drive around and fly around and talk to people that's a common problem. And but just the amount and the passion with which people responded was surprised me. And so I think today, unless we just start talking about other stuff that's, I don't know, maybe more interesting, but we're going to talk more about a combination of small footprint and booting quickly. And I know there's like a standard division of labor here in the great TimeSys podcast empire or whatever, but I know Maciej usually handles the kernel side of things. And I usually stick with user space because that's something simple I can understand. And there's strategies both. There's things you can do in both places that can make your life a lot easier with respect to making your system, make an air quote, small. And then usually small also means quickly booting. Yeah. And I think this will, maybe it won't though, but I think it will sort of dovetail in with what we talked about the last time.
Absolutely. And I think that fast boot can't live without small footprint.
Oh, yeah.
The other way around, it actually is very much possible because people are constrained with the space that they have available on embedded device to store the application and the entire root file system. But, having a fast-booting kernel with a large root file system and a lot of services, not such a good idea. So, as you said, Gene, today I think we'll have fun with a number of topics around both user space and kernel space, and see how you like it. And again, if you have any questions or feedback as we go through this podcast, I just wanted to bring it up right from the start. Let us know, please.
speaking of which, here's a question I get from customers all the time. So I go, or they call me on the phone, and I say, well, how do I know? So I have this kernel configuration tool, and you gave me some documentation, but how do I know what I can take out? I'm fearful that if I take out certain things mm-hmm. or different things, I go through this configuration program, I have lots of options, I'm scared, I don't want to make a mess of anything. How do I know what I can take out?
Are you talking about kernel?
On the kernel side. I hear that all the time.
Yeah.
And so usually, times we have some help with documentation, we can point users to say, hey, you can take it this, but I'm going to be that person watching, and I imagine sitting across from me at a customer site, and I say, well, what can I do? I mean, is there something easy I can do? Like, what can I take out of my kernel?
Well, so one way of looking at it is actually, and I've seen that approach at many places as customers were designing that fast boot system. They were simply going through designing a graph, simply putting the execution path in a form of a tree uh-huh. to understand better what their requirements are as far as what their application will need, and then trying to overlay that on top of what kernel comes with, the default configuration. And that was very helpful. Because as you go through a kernel configuration and you do understand your requirements mm-hmm. For the kernel, the execution path where you really could save time, mm-hmm. You can very quickly remove some of the things that are in the kernel. Another approach is there's been this initiative going on in the past called Tiny Kernel, I think.
Yeah. So there's a decent set of patches out there on CELF's
yes.
website. Because some guy, he put in a ton of effort into doing that, and I think his patches were dropped. I actually think they dropped maintenance of them, which is Well, a bummer.
Actually, what happened was they got merged into a Linux kernel mainline and no longer live as separate patches. So they were available up to the kernel version, I believe, 2.6.15.
Mm-hmm.
But now there's an option inside the Linux kernel with which you can turn on a lot of those features that were previously enabled by the tiny kernel patches. So that option is called config embedded.
Uh-huh.
And when you do that, a lot of features, well, the kernel will attempt to build only a minimalistic scenario for the end user.
Yeah. Well, it turns, I remember there's a great big set of patches, and one of the things that struck me as most interesting of all the things, and I thought, ooh, this guy's a smart guy, right, is they turned off inlining.
Yeah.
It was one of the compiler options that they turned off, which results in a greater savings than you would think. But there, I guess when you talk about kernel minimization patches, there are things along that line. Some of them have to do with reducing the internal static buffers that the kernel allocates, mm-hmm. right? Because if it's static, it has to lay out that much memory in the image.
Yeah.
And then some of the other things involve simply compiling with switches that are more likely to produce a smaller image size.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, I remember one of those was turning off inlining. And I thought, wow, someone's smart.
No, absolutely. I think that the whole config embedded and Tiny Linux helps users to very quickly prune unnecessary stuff out of a kernel with just one kernel option, and then getting to a fairly small size of binary Linux kernel at the end.
Yeah.
So it can be a very good starting point for someone that designs a system that is supposed to boot fast or that is supposed to have a smaller footprint.
Yeah. You know what, Maciej, and I don't mean to put you on the spot, but do we have a URL for that? Or should this actually be in our... Because one of the things that marketing nags us for all the time, we finish these up and like, well, you should make some speaker notes, and we get this thing about that we're not doing a good job with the follow-up. And so maybe with this time, we'll get motivated. And we'll supply and we'll supply the config, because I know there's a URL that explains what we have to do, or not explains, but says what's in that config embedded.
Yes.
And so maybe this will prompt us to actually do a good job this time.
Yes.
With respect to following up with some notes.
I agree. I think this is a great idea, and I'm sure that we'll do better job this time on writing the notes for this particular podcast.
Yeah, hopefully. So, maybe. That's the plan, at least, right?
Well, and so this is just one of the topics that we talked about so far, right? How to use something that's already pre-built into a kernel to get the size of the Linux kernel smaller out of the box. But we mentioned last time a number of configuration options that can help in getting the... Linux kernel booting fast. And one of the options I think you brought up last time was the quiet option.
Oh, yeah. That does miracles. It really does. You get all those messages that fly by.
Yeah.
You can turn on quiet, and voila, no messages fly by. And it's interesting, and I know it's in that config embedded URL too, but I believe in the config in that set of patches, they've stubbed out printk. In essence, printk black holes, right? And so I also thought that was a wondrously intelligent trick.
Yep.
So if for whatever reason you can't get that config, if you can't change your kernel at this point, you might be hamstrung by whatever sort of changes you have internally. Like you might not be able to get that change in. At least you can twiddle with the command line and say quiet, and that'll suppress the messages from coming over. It's amazing how much time those take. It really is.
Well, plus this is actually a runtime option, so you can. It's something that you can change on the fly. So if you have a device out in the field, and for diagnostic purposes, you would like to see still the booting messages, all you do is, I guess, remove the quiet option from the kernel command line.
Yeah.
And then all the print case.
Whammo! There you go.
Yeah.
Yeah, you can actually get diagnosis again.
Yeah, that's actually a fantastic option.
It really is. I mean, part of the thing about taking it out of the kernel entirely is you've lost that bit of diagnostic feedback. But you're right. I mean, if you set it up as a runtime thing and you can get in there and just kick the bootloader a little bit, you can put yourself back into that state and get some useful feedback messages. One of the things that you were talking about, Maciej, was I know you explained it to me twice and you went real slow. I still didn't figure it out. You're talking about reducing application startup time through pre-linking.
Yes.
And could you explain it a third? I don't get it.
Yeah. Well, so it's actually a way of reducing a job that's done by a dynamic linker. So if you have an application, right, that requires or links during the runtime with a lot of dynamic libraries.
Yeah, yeah.
When you invoke that application, linker itself on target has to do a lot of work trying to find the relocations and all that.
So one of the things, that, I don't mean to interrupt too much, mm-hmm. but one of the things that folks in the may not have a grip around, that I guess when I found out, I thought this was amazing, right? But when you actually invoke something that's dynamically linked with Linux, what really happens is that the system goes to some executable on the file system and runs your program as a parameter to that executable, and then that executable goes through and resolves all the addresses.
Like, an executable that you're talking about is really a linker.
Oh, right. Yeah, so this, the executable that's running is a linker. And so what it'll do is it'll take your program as input, it'll read the import header table, and then bring everything in and begin to resolve all the addresses before your program runs.
Yes.
So... And that's something that so whenever you run something that's dynamically linked, what you're really loading two programs. The first, this linker program that does the fix up, and then your program once it's ready to run.
So you can greatly optimize that by simply putting that information already in those executables, and that's what pruning actually helps you with. And it as long as you're not changing your application and libraries, that approach will work.
So wait a second. So I'm sorry, this is like the fifth time or the fourth time or whatever. Maybe you'll understand. So what happens is that pre-linking does the job of that linker program that runs first
tables.
And resolves all the addresses.
Yes.
And then that's the image that you run with the addresses resolved.
Yes. So the dynamic linker doesn't have to do much when you execute that on that application on the target, because application already knows where to jump for specific symbols. It has to, of course, load libraries and all that into memory, and those symbols have to be available for the application. But with pre-link, you would greatly reduce time that your application requires to really run.
So how do I pre-link? I didn't even get. I know before you got like really frustrated as you explained this to me. Like I didn't get through my skull. But
yeah.
So if I want to do pre-link, like what do I do to pre-link?
Well, you actually do that at the compile time, I believe, and you do that before you deploy your application to a target.
So there's like some magic switch I send into GCC. Do you know what that is? Can you remember?
Don't remember exactly the switches and how
the same time we get that config embedded URL, we'll put that there. So it's thing number two.
Yes, I think that's something that would be of a huge interest to customers.
Yeah,
because again, some applications tend to grow uncontrollably.
And oh yeah,
pre-link is very helpful in those scenarios. That it can greatly reduce. The startup time for those applications, even by 30% sometimes.
Oh, that's cool. And then when you're working on a slower board, that really means something, right?
Yes.
But you're right, because I mean the application is not, it's not like a traditional desktop system where things can shift around. It's not going to change. You can safely do that optimization, and then still get some of the benefits of a shared library at the same time.
Right. Well, so another way of basically trying to speed up your application is to do. Another level of optimization, which is profiling.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So with profilers, you can really analyze your code from the standpoint of where the time is spent in your application and try to figure out if the way you've written your application simply puts in too many loops in at specific line in code, and that's what's causing, let's say, performance hit.
Yeah, well, we use OProfile for that here. When we do that kind of, I know, not here, but me. I'm sure about other folks, I'm sure. But yeah, we use OProfile a lot because it really does, it does great things. It gives you pass counts. And then not only does it give you pass counts, but it gives you time spent per line even. And then you can drill up,
It's got pretty pictures, though, too, right?
Yeah, I like the pictures.
It can visually indicate where in the code the processor is spending most time.
Yeah.
And then you can drill down by just clicking specific bar graphic on the graph,
yep.
and that will take you straight into the code.
Yeah. Yeah, it does make it easy. Because sometimes you code yourself an inner loop, and then you don't really understand how many times that passes by. And,
yeah.
And, you know, you really can't – I don't care what people say about loop optimization and whatever else the compiler does, right?
Yeah.
The compiler can't make up for boneheaded coding, right?
Right.
And everyone does that.
Plus, we all been through that experience where simply too many hours in front of a computer and you compile the program, you're happy, and then you run the program, and, well, something's wrong, right?
Yeah.
And because you wrote the program, you're biased and you can't really see what's wrong with it. I mean, where the bottleneck is.
I
think that the old profile is like the second pair of eyes that looks at your code and helps you understand what compiler really did to that code, right? And helps you track some of the blocks of code where, the time is spent.
Yeah, and it really gets handy too if you're working on it really gets handy too when you're working on a project with like four other guys or five other people, and then, you know, you're using someone else's code. You don't really know what it's doing, and so, you know, someone's giving you an API and you're totally abusing it, right, in order to get your job done. And and you found out that, you know, your abuse of the this other guy's API is actually causing some performance issues because you're not using it correctly.
Yeah.
Or you could be doing a better job.
Yeah. So, application optimization is one side as well, but all applications live in various root file systems. And I know, Gene, that you've been talking, presenting at various places what are different selections and which type of file system to choose for a specific application. But for an embedded application that is size and speed conscious, what are the options?
Well, you know what, and this is a crappy answer, but it depends, right?
Mm.
So there are a couple of things you have to worry about. First, you have to worry about the hardware you're running on, and depending on how your file system is stored. And then the other constraints are what you need to do with your file system once it's there. So the first sort of division is, well, are you running on like a flash-based device, what they call an MTD device?
Okay, so let's assume at first that that's the scenario that end user wants to deploy into a flash.
Ah, so then you have to two questions, because flash is an overused, very overused term. So you have the one where it's a flash that has what they call a translation layer on it that makes the flash device appear to you like some regular hard drive with a spindle in it. Okay.
Yep.
And, you know, it's just slipping my mind what that device is called, but if it presents itself that way. And the other thing is,
we'll put it in the notes.
Yeah, we'll put it in the notes. So, sorry. So, you know, we're never going to do that. It's never going to happen. So, and then the other thing is, the other of it's just a raw flash device. It's a standard MTD device that just appears as flash memory. So if you're going to go the MTD device, you need a wear leveling file system.
Yeah.
And in fact, and I won't bore the audience but there's a lot of differences between a file system that's specialized for flash, because the flash works with different, you know, represents its memory, its store, in a substantially different manner. But there's two big things out there. One's called YFFS, which is yet another flash file system. Mm-hmm. Two. They all have to end in two. And then the other one is JFFS, which is Journaling Flash File System, two.
Actually, what I've seen actually customers do, those that have enough flash, they go for an uncompressed version of the root file system.
Oh, yeah.
And that's, I guess, the difference between the two, right? That JFFS2 is really a very compressed version of a root file system, and yet another flash file system, too, has no or low level of compression.
Yeah.
Thus, it takes less time for an application to really load into memory.
Yes. Yeah, with all these, you get in, not only do you have device trade-offs, right, but you also have the classic time versus storage trade-off. So you know, for any of these file systems, you can specify, you know, even if it's not running on a flash, you can specify compression, and even what's compressed is different.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, I guess but still going back to the filing systems is that the wear leveling file systems are designed because or designed that way because for flash you can't write to any one area or put it this way for any area of flash there's a certain duty cycle
right
and so you have to be careful to spread your changes around the media so that not one place gets most of the writes.
Right.
But some of the interesting issues is that makes the file system very non-deterministic with respect to operation time.
Right.
As you get into these things, you find out both of these manipulate these things called erase blocks,
mm-hmm.
which is where you can write data, and then it keeps track of what's eligible to be replaced, and then does a garbage collection step.
Right.
But there are times when you can do a write, you can do an append to a file, and find yourself waiting a while,
right?
As the system goes around and tries to figure out where to put the memory and or where to put that change right down on the file system, mm-hmm. and that sort of delay, depending upon your application, can range between irritating and disastrous with respect to the user's experience.
So, is there really an option for an application that needs to boot fast and actually? Customer is using a soldered onboard flash device that actually requires a wear level approach.
Yeah, so there's a couple different ways to go from there. There are several file systems that are in fact read only. I would say they're write only file systems.
Okay, so that's
what does that mean? But but they're read only file systems, and so you can take an area flash and you can put a file system on it, like CramFS or ROMFS or even EXT2. A journaling EXT3 is EXT2 with journaling.
Yeah.
And journaling on a read only file system.
Yeah, but if you really have to write to a flash device,
if you really have to write to it, I would recommend getting. A file system and putting a little area in RAM and then being clever about what you write into RAM and then what you write onto the flash. Because eventually you're still going to be in the same pickle. Yeah. One way or another, you're still going to be in the same pickle where you're going to have unpredictable behavior with respect to how it handles erase blocks when your device reaches its limits.
Well, so I guess one of the approaches that you already talked about is to keep the application and the entire system in the onboard flash in a read-only mode,
mm-hmm.
and then have some sort of an external flash device connected to the platform via USB or something, or if customer is lucky, through an onboard compact flash port or something. And have the data from application one being stored in a separate device.
Or in a different partition. Because you can always sit, if you think about it, you can be clever about your writes and you can have a RAM disk or something along those lines, and you can queue up your writes in RAM, and then you can be clever about when you decide to flush that, put that down on top of flash and store it persistently.
Mm-hmm.
Most users, I mean, if you have a device that is, how can I put it? Like the way the user interacts with it is such that they're going to store a lot of data, and that's simply the way the device is going to work. Like one of those fancy PDA things, or I don't know what the kids are playing with these days. But if you have something like that, well, necessarily you're going to look at getting a higher performance compact flash device that has. The compact flash is a device that looks like an it looks like a regular drive, an IDE drive, and so it has what they call the flash translation layer built into it.
Right.
And those handle wear leveling substantially faster.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't know whether they did a better job or not. That's, I guess you could have a debate about that. But they do handle writes a lot faster. And so if you find yourself in that situation, and that's the requirements of the device, you're probably going to find yourself going down the route of using some compact flash so you can get the right level of performance for most of your writes.
So since we talked about flash and storage device in general, I think that there's another topic that we haven't touched upon yet, which is an approach to avoiding instead of loading executables to RAM, and it's called execute in place, and it allows both kernel and application to run straight from a flash device.
Yeah.
And again, that's another area that customers look at, because loading anything to memory takes time. And if you have large application, allocating memory and getting everything into the memory greatly increases the impression of startup time.
Yeah.
I mean, diminishes it. It's a negative more than positive.
Yeah.
But again, there are trade-offs because it's great to have a fast system startup time and use the execute-in-place technology.
Mm-hmm.
But if your application is called very frequently, and, for example, links with some additional dynamic libraries, it's probably better to keep that in RAM, because the performance is greater. I mean, speed is much greater in accessing files.
Mm-hmm.
But if you want to execute something from flash device, execute in place is definitely one of the approaches to consider.
Yeah. Well, you know what's up in 2.6, I guess, we talked about this a little before we, I guess, turned on the microphone. But one of the things we did talk about a little bit was the initramfs. There's a new fangled file system out there for embedded. I would say it's embedded. It's in fact, it's used by default in the Linux kernel, mm-hmm. and where you can populate a file, you can create a file which is in essence which when the kernel loads is loaded right into the directory cache inside mm-hmm. the kernel, and there's a file system that is in essence an alias on top of a node cache,
mm-hmm.
and that enables you to do things like combine. Well, you combine your kernel, even the build for your initial RAM file system, into the kernel build process.
Mm-hmm.
Because you, with the kernel, you can go in there and you can point at this particular directory, and it'll sweep up all of that data. It'll actually create a CPIO archive.
Yes.
I think it's funny. It's, you know, CPIO yeah. is what older than...
well, you know, initial ideas are always, or the simplest ideas have the best. Right?
Yeah, I know the Ford Falcon, I think, was introduced whenever they were whenever CPIO came out, right? So in essence, it's a CPIO archive, and that's created. And what's nice about CPIO is it does a good job of sweeping up device nodes and everything else, right? And then you can that's loaded right into memory when the kernel starts, and the kernel sort of expects it. As a matter of fact, the way 2.6 is written, the kernel startup, is that there, in essence, is always an initramfs pointer. It's just whether yeah. it's populated with anything or not.
And I guess another reason why working with initial RAM file systems is usually faster than with initial RAM disks
mm-hmm.
is that initial RAM disk is utilizing also a block device driver.
Mm-hmm.
So the execution path to access any node on that root file system is far longer than one of initial RAM file system.
Yeah. Well, the other curious thing, too, is the... I don't mean to super geek out here. The other thing, too, is that the EXT2... Most of those initial RAM disks are EXT2 formatted.
Mm-hmm.
The EXT2 module is like 130K. It's big, right?
Yeah.
And so if you use something like initramfs for your initial RAM disk, you can do something right away like set up, or you can do something right away like eliminate EXT2, and you'll gain like 130K
yeah.
Off your kernel size. So, I mean, there's some memory savings there as well, too.
Yeah. And another great thing about the initial RAM file system is that, I think that you were talking about it a bit, but that at the end, when you build a initial RAM file system and the Linux kernel, you get as the output a single image that it's easier to deploy. It's easier to flash it onto a device because
oh, yeah.
you go only through one set of steps And you don't have to necessarily play with addresses inside, on board once you load everything up, like with initial RAM disks or some other root file system types, where you have to first load the initial RAM disk or the file system into memory, load the kernel, and then point the kernel to a location memory where the file system lives.
Yeah.
By using initial RAM file system, all that is eliminated.
Yeah, right.
Because the kernel already knows where the RAM file system is.
The other thing is, but I will point out, it's like there's always trade-offs, right? So there's initial RAM disk trade-offs, too. Init RAM FS. I'll use the right name, because I'm sure someone will write it. Yeah, sure enough. But the initial, using init RAM FS does have some drawbacks. And first and foremost is that what you have is an alias on top of the node cache.
Yeah.
And it's untethered with respect to the amount of memory you can consume.
Right.
So if you have an application that logs data every 30 seconds or something, and then it'll keep doing that to what's allocated all memory. Mm-hmm. And so you do need to be careful there. I think there's TempFS, if I recall. Yes, it is TempFS. Mm-hmm. But there's TempFS, and you can use that to create a file system that works, that is, again, an alias on top of the node cache in Linux. However, you can bound the size, and that's extremely important if you want to set up a system where it'll behave predictably at capacity at limits, right? Because if you use init RAM FS, the first thing the QA guy is going to do, right? Because you know the job of QA is to make your life miserable and to break your application and to make you come in on the weekends or whatever else. They're going to come in and they're going to overrun your log file if they know what does that. Which, number one, you shouldn't tell your QA guys anything, right? The mistake is telling them something. But if they know it logs data, the first thing they're going to do is they're going to wind up the capacity and break that. So if you find yourself in that situation, make sure you're using some file system where you can limit the size.
But I guess where customers are lucky or basically where the process is successful is that when the QA team asks about log files, right, at that stage, the project is still in a development phase, and customer tends to use a rather different approach for root file system, I guess, like NFS mounted root file system or something that has hundreds of libraries and utilities that development and QA team can probe the system with. But there are a lot of applications that are deployed in the field that have capability of providing output from run, right? Whatever run is, if it's an execution or standby, or a lot of those applications have also some sort of a connection to the company that is using that device in the field. So it's kind of like devices deployed in the field, but you can collect data on fly. And a lot of times data is not really logged on the root file system, but is also sent straight through a TCP/IP connection back to a logging facility.
I know there's ways to mediate that, but it's certainly there. It's a risk you have to be aware of.
Absolutely.
And like I said, if you have good testers and good people like that, that is something that they're going to exploit and make sure that you did a good job on. There's one other thing I want to bring up about init RAM FS. I'm sorry, I think we're going over, but that's too bad. So the other thing about
one.
I'm sure 80% of the people listening have already hit the stop button. That's on them. But I lost my train of thought. Oh, the other thing about init RAM FS is that because it is linked in right with the kernel, I knew you get the benefit. You can build at the same time. You can deploy at the same time. But you also have a little bit of an issue with respect to doing updates on your root file system independent of your kernel. Because this is Linux, right? So those are two separate entities. Mm-hmm. And if you put those two things together, you run into risks. And you have to be really good about freezing your kernel code when it goes out, which you should be doing anyway, right? But sometimes you don't, right? It happens, right? So you have to be really good about freezing out your kernel code so that when you want to go modify your root file system, you can make those modifications
independent.
independent and then do your rebuild, because they still are separate entities. So you got to make sure that, because you really run into issues, because that means you've changed, in essence, how you've changed your application, but you need to affect that change by redoing a kernel build. And it said it doesn't reduce some extra work in that respect.
And I think that this is more of a process that companies have in place for building their application. Well, and if companies don't have that process in place but are interested in utilizing initial RAM file system, that's definitely an area where they should consider.
Yeah, and most folks that do that, you know, have been in the embedded world for a while, I mean, they have that concept in their head where they will combine the OS and the root file system anyway. So it's like a familiar concept to them. So they sort of understand, they'll have their head around, and they usually have the right practices anyway in place. But I just wanted to bring it up because it's like any other engineering thing, right? You have some amount of trade-off.
And I guess that takes us back also to the fact that there are other operating systems in embedded space that are very monolithic, that where you have the root file system application combined with the operating system.
You don't even have a root file system. Depending on how things are set up, it's just all linked
connect,
in one
link together.
Thing, yeah.
Right. But I guess a lot of embedded engineers are coming from with that thought in their mind, and they want to mimic that approach in Linux. And initial RAM file system is by far the best approach.
Yeah. So I think I think we're done for today.
Well, yes, for today.
For today, so we're done. So if you have any questions or comments, drop us a line, podcast@timesys.com. Or I think you can visit the podcast page at lldn.timesys.com. There's a button there somewhere. Who knows where it is? I think if you click under learn, whatever. But there's a podcast page, and at the bottom you can leave some notes if you want to drop us a line that way. I know most folks are fairly... I wouldn't say shy, but I know the preferred method is email. So please email. We will read them and do our best to get back to you.
And also, we would like to ask you for any ideas of what else you would like to hear about around Linux from us. And we are also very much interested in what you are doing and the types of projects that you're designing and the kind of problems that you're running into. Maybe we can explore some of those areas live during one of our podcasts.
Yeah, I know for however much we've been doing embedded work before, whenever you talk to a customer, you always learn something new. They're always doing something different. And so it's a great way to figure out what's out there. But then for as much as people do different things, a lot of folks still run into the same sorts of problems.
Yeah.
And we just want to make sure that if we take up some of your time, that we at least talk about problems that are that you're trying to solve and help you out that way. So, all done. Thanks a lot.
Thank you very much for your attention.
This podcast was brought to you by TimeSys. Check out our new site to get free code, discuss, and learn about embedded Linux development. Go to timesys.com today.